You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. If you are listening to the podcast of this, it is located at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. As well, there are two publishing houses, SteinerBooks.org in America and RudolfSteinerPress.com in London, that are the sole translators of Steiner into English and have given me permission to do these recordings. Please consider patronizing them as well. This is a reading of a collected works, volume 181 by Rudolf Steiner, that contains three cycles: Dying Earth and Living Cosmos, The Living Gifts of Anthroposophy, The Need for New Forms of Consciousness, translated by Matthew Barton. This is Lecture 6 of the first cycle, given in Berlin on the 19th of March, 1918. A week ago, we explored more intimate questions of the life of the human psyche, questions that can aptly prepare the ground for consideration of how the so-called living, that is, the human souls living in physical bodies, relate to disembodied souls, to those at present living in the period between death and rebirth. When exploring this theme, we need to familiarize ourselves with certain basic ideas to lead us into the right kind of soul engagement, the way in which we can and should think of ourselves within such relationships. The reality of such a relationship, you see, has no bearing on whether or not a person living here on earth is aware of his connection with this or that being in the world of spirit. What I say now will be self-evident for anyone who reflects upon such things. But in the realm of spiritual science, it is sometimes necessary to remind ourselves clearly of self-evident matters. We always have a relationship to the world of spirit, and always also a certain connection with the dead with whom we are karmically connected in some way. It is therefore quite different to speak of the reality of this connection, or of a greater or lesser awareness of its possibility. But it is important for everyone, even for those compelled to discount this, to learn what such an awareness tells us. It tells us, in fact, of realities in which we enduringly exist. As far as our relationship with the so-called dead is concerned, we have to realize one thing in particular, that this relationship is harder to be aware of, in a sense, than our relationship with other beings of the world of spirit. It is somewhat easier to develop awareness of the beings of the higher hierarchies through imaginative perception, and even to receive certain revelations from these higher hierarchies, than to become aware of a quite specific relationship we have with the dead. In other words, to become aware of it in a true and authentic way. This is due to the following. In our life between death and rebirth, we pass through conditions of existence that are very different indeed from those in the physical world. And as I explained in the lecture cycle titled The Inner Nature of Man and the Life Between Death and a New Birth, require correspondingly different thoughts and ideas. Why, you may ask, are the ideas we employ to describe these realities so different from what we are otherwise familiar with? As we will study this winter, this is because, between death and a new birth, we prefigure, in a certain way, the conditions that will only arise during the next planetary embodiment of the Earth, that of Jupiter. After death, we live in a finer spiritual state, which is reminiscent of future Jupiter conditions. Here, during our life, our earthly incarnation, we have retained something of the Earth's former embodiments, those of Moon, Sun, and Saturn. And therefore, in the life between death and a new birth, we balance this by absorbing something of the future. By contrast, all the beings of the higher hierarchies, insofar as we can understand them with our human vision, relate to the present form of the whole world of spirit, are connected with the way it manifests at present. In future, these beings will manifest future conditions. It sounds very paradoxical, I know, but it is so. It sounds paradoxical because one can then ask how these beings of the higher hierarchies can act upon the dead, since the latter already bear futurity within them. Naturally, the beings of the higher hierarchies also bear the future in them, and have the capacity to form the future. But they do not do this without creating something in the realm where the dead reside that is directly characteristic of the present. We, therefore, have to prepare ourselves for awareness of our dialogue with the dead by perceiving what the hierarchies accomplish. And only when we succeed in invoking in the soul a more or less conscious sense of the beings of the higher hierarchies will it gradually become possible for the soul to become aware of communication with the dead, based on a new capacity for perception and feeling. This does not necessarily mean that we should perceive the higher hierarchies clairvoyantly, but insofar as spiritual science allows us to do this, and it does, we should understand what it is that flows into existence from these higher hierarchies. Understanding is important in relation to all these things. Only when we make efforts to understand them through spiritual science can the conditions arise in which we become aware, to some degree at least, of a connection between the so-called living and the so-called dead. To grasp this, we need to consider the following. The world of spirit in which we exist, between death and rebirth, has its own very distinctive nature, involving conditions of existence that we usually scarcely notice in our ordinary life on earth, and which, when voiced as part of a person's outlook, sound fairly paradoxical and peculiar. For a conscious sense of such things, it is of the greatest importance to acquire a feeling, which I will call a real sense of community with the realities of existence. To gradually develop this feeling of community and companionship with the realities of existence is something required by humanity's ongoing evolution from the present, this catastrophic present, onward. The foundations of this sense of community, albeit not yet in a developed form, are already present in the subconscious. But rather than speaking in very general terms, as the pantheists do, of some kind of universal spirit, of a feeling of community, we must gain detailed clarity about the meaning of such a phrase, and how this feeling can form and unfold in the soul. You see, this feeling of community arises through life itself, and here we must consider the following. You have no doubt heard of criminals, in whom instinctual nature works very strongly in the subconscious, who are driven to return to the scene of their crime. They seek out the place where they committed their crime, driven by an undefined sense. A phenomenon like this is only a specific instance of something that works more generally in people. When we have done something, anything at all, even an act of no apparent significance, something remains in us, which we can only express in a kind of picture, of the thing we took hold of when we performed our action. The object we took hold of remains in us as a certain energy, remains connected with our I, capital. We inevitably enter into certain connections with all the entities we encounter and the things we take hold of. I do not, of course, only mean the grasping hold of a physical object. We connect with everything which our actions engage with, and everywhere we leave behind signs of our activity. And in our subconscious there remains a sense of our connection with the things we have engaged with through our actions. In criminals this comes to abnormal expression because their subconscious shines up very powerfully and instinctively into their ordinary awareness. Yet in the subconscious, all of us have the sense that we must return to what we encountered and engaged with in our actions. This is also what our karma is founded on, and where it originates. We have a general feeling of community with the world, which initially impinges on our existence in only a nebulous way. And this sense of community with things is due really to the fact that we leave signs of our presence everywhere. We can intuit this sense of community in ourselves, creep up on it, as it were. But to do so, we have to consider certain subtleties of life. You have to really feel your way into a picture or idea. Say you are walking along a road, and in doing so, and having done so, you keep picturing yourself doing this. By invoking this always as you walk along, you draw forth from your soul a general sense of community with the world. In someone who becomes more tangibly aware of this sense of community, it develops to the point where he can say that a connection exists, albeit invisible, between himself and all things, and its nature is similar to the connection between all the limbs of an organism. Just as each finger, every earlobe, everything in our organism belongs to us, and all is connected with everything else, so there is a connection between all things and everything that happens insofar as it impinges on our world. People alive on earth today do not yet have a fully developed sense of this collective or social quality, this organic permeation of things. They are not yet aware of it, but it exists in the unconscious. During Jupiter evolution, this sense will be the foundation of life. And as we gradually evolve from the fifth post-Atlantean era toward the sixth, we are working to develop this feeling. Developing it is necessary as we move from our present era to a future one. And this must create a distinctive ethical or moral foundation for humanity, one much more alive and vibrant than morality is today. I mean this in the following way. Nowadays, people are not greatly bothered by the thought that they are enriching themselves at others' expense. It is not just that they don't feel any qualms of conscience about this, but that it does not even occur to them to think about it. If they did, they would discover that we live at the expense of others to a far greater extent than is realized. Awareness will gradually develop that living at the expense of others, also in society, is the same thing as if a particular organ developed inappropriately and lived at the expense of another bodily organ. People will come to see that an individual's happiness is in reality not possible without the happiness of all. They do not yet have any inkling of this, but it must gradually become the principle at work in true human morality. Today, each person seeks his own happiness initially and does not reflect that one's own happiness only has a sound basis in the happiness of all. Thus, a connection exists between the sense of community with the world, which I described, and a feeling that the whole of social existence is an organism. People can develop an enhanced sense of this, a greatly intensified awareness of it. We can develop an intimate sense of our community with all things around us. If we enhance and intensify this feeling, we gradually create a capacity to perceive what I described in the last lecture as the beam of light we shed forward into the future, beyond death, into our development between death and a new birth, when we perceive it and form our karma from it. I wish only to indicate this today. When we develop this sense of community and companionship with the world, We also acquire the capacity to fully accept and accommodate the situations, thoughts, and actions of another person as if they were our own. This involves a certain difficulty for our psyche. To imagine another's reality, so that we can experience what he thinks and feels as our own. But if we are going to think back in fruitful ways to what we shared and had in common with the dead, with whom we formed karmic connections while we were still alive, we will only succeed in making real contact with them in their disembodied state if we are able to remember the shared experiences we had with them, even of minor significance. With the quality of thinking we possess when aware of this sense of community. So imagine that you think about something that occurred between yourself and a person who has since died. Say you were sitting at table with him or went for a walk or some other minor event. The soul will only be able to fully enter into this situation in a way that makes it reality if it truly possesses this sense of community. Otherwise, it will not have sufficient strength to do so. Let us be clear about this. A dead soul can only impinge on our awareness from a place, I'm speaking metaphorically, but you will understand me, upon which we shine this feeling of community. You can picture this in spatial terms if you like, but you must remember, of course, that this is only a picture. Nevertheless, it is the picture of a reality. Let me return to what I was saying before. You picture a specific situation with a person now dead, say, sitting at a table or going for a walk with him. And then you focus your whole soul on this thought. If, in this thought, you develop a soul community with the dead person in a way that accords with the sense of community I have described, his gaze from the world of spirit can discern this thought in the same way that your thought, your orientation of thought, finds the reality upon which it is focused. Allow this thought of the dead person to be present in your loving soul with the degree of intensity I have described, and the focus of your vision of soul will meet that of the dead person. By this means, he can speak to you. He can only speak to you from the place upon which the focus of your sense of community with him falls. Thus are things connected. We learn to feel our karma by acquiring a picture of how we leave marks or signs of our thinking everywhere. If we learn to identify with things in this way, we develop the sense that can bring us into ever more conscious communion with the dead. This is the basis for the dead to speak to us. The other thing necessary is for us to hear it, to really be able to perceive it as time goes by. Here, above all, we must attend to the air, in quotes, that must lie between us and the dead person so that what he utters can find its way across to us. One can make a comparison here with physics. If there were a vacuum between us, you could not hear what I am saying. Likewise, between the living and the dead, something must exist, a medium, whereby the dead can approach us. This is spiritual air, and we can now describe what this spiritual air consists of, in which we have a shared existence with the dead. What is it composed of? To grasp this, we must remember something I have previously described in a different context, that is, how memory arises. You see, things are all connected. Orthodox psychology sees human memory like this. I receive an impression from the outside world, and this creates a picture or thought in me. Then this picture travels somehow through my subconscious, is forgotten, and when a particular cause arises, it emerges again from the subconscious, and I remember. As far as memory is concerned, almost all psychologists have the sense, more or less, that an impression causes a thought, which fades after a while, is forgotten, and makes its way through the subconscious, then comes to our awareness again through some cause or other. We remember and believe we have the same thought or picture again that we originally formed. But this is utter nonsense, despite being taught in almost every school of psychology. This simply does not happen. When we form an impression in response to an outer experience that impinges on us, and later recall this experience, the original thought or picture does not surface in us again. Instead, it is like this. As we think or picture something, a second subconscious process is occurring at the same time, but we are unaware of this while we have the initial experience. This is happening below the level of our awareness, and in processes that I will not describe now, what occurred today unconsciously occurs again tomorrow in our organism. On the first day, an outer impression elicits a thought or picture, and on the next day, the subconscious effect of this calls forth the new picture or thought. A thought I have today fades and disappears and no longer exists. It does not travel around in a subconscious realm. But when I remember the event or outer impression tomorrow, this is because there is something within me which calls forth this same thought. But it has been engendered in the subconscious. If you think that thoughts or pictures are absorbed by our subconscious, journey around there, and eventually surface again from there, you might as well imagine that when you write something down with the aim of recalling it in 3 days, the person, say, whom you wish to remember, has taken refuge in what you wrote and walks out of your jottings again 3 days later. Just as these jottings are composed only of marks on paper, likewise our memory contains only a sign or indicator, and this evokes again what we experienced, though in a weaker degree. There are various spiritual scientific aspects of this that we can explore, and we will do so. And then what I am about to explain will become very clear. Today, though, I just wish to recall one thing. Anyone who tries to memorize or teach himself something that is retained, which can be very hard graft, as we may remember from our youth, is fully aware that simply absorbing or perceiving something is not sufficient to ensure this. To lodge something in our mind or memory, we may often have to resort to very external props and aids. If you observe someone who is trying to lodge something in his mind, you will see what exertions he has to make to gain the aid of the unconscious activity that occurs in the process. One makes efforts to somehow support this subconscious activity. There are two very distinct things involved here. Firstly, lodging something in the mind, and secondly, recalling it at need. If you study people and their character, you will soon discover that these two things are different. Some people can quickly grasp and absorb something, but have a terribly poor memory. And vice versa, there are people who are dull as ditch water when it comes to grasping something quickly, but who have a good power of recall, in particular a well-developed capacity to think and judge. These two things are quite distinct, and spiritual science will need to highlight what actually happens here. When we absorb and grasp something in daily life, which we do, of course, from first thing in the morning until we fall asleep again at night, what we absorb is more or less consciously accompanied by our sympathies and antipathies, and we are usually pleased to have grasped or understood something. But the activity that leads subsequently to memory is a far broader and more diffuse one than the activity needed to grasp impressions. In the soul, a very great deal occurs subconsciously, and this subconscious activity sometimes strangely contradicts what is happening in our conscious mind. Sometimes an impression can elicit antipathies in us. Our subconscious has no sense of these antipathies at all, for it experiences our impressions in a quite different way from ordinary awareness. the response of the subconscious, to all impressions, is a sense that I can describe in no other way than by saying, though this is put metaphorically and must always be so when one takes expressions from the physical world and applies them to the realm of spirit, but here the expression is very apt, that the subconscious feels a sense of gratitude toward every impression, quite irrespective of what occurs in our conscious mind. Someone can be standing in front of you and hurl the worst insults in your face, and yet it is still true to say that your subconscious feels a certain sense of gratitude toward these impressions. This sense of gratitude exists because everything that touches on the deeper elements of our being enriches our life, really enriches it. Even all unpleasant impressions enrich it. This has no bearing on how we have to respond to outer impressions. Our conscious response or reaction has nothing at all to do with what occurs subconsciously, where everything leads only to a certain sense of gratitude. Our subconscious takes every impression as a gift for which it feels gratitude. It is extremely important to reflect on this reality occurring below the level of consciousness. What is at work there, and issues in a sense of gratitude, acts in a similar way to how an outward impression impinges on us and starts to become internalized as memory. This runs alongside and distinct from thinking. And we can only become aware of these things if we acquire a clear sense of the fact that we are dreaming throughout our waking life. In a public lecture, I have said that we are continually sleeping and dreaming, even in waking life, as far as our feelings and will are concerned. As we let the world impinge on us, our impressions and thoughts continually occur. But beneath this, we dream about everything. This dream life is far richer than we think, and is merely outshone by our conscious mind, just as a weaker light is outshone by a stronger one. It is possible to experiment with this and gain insight into it by attending to diverse subtleties in life. For instance, try the following. Imagine you are lying down asleep and then wake up. Usually we pay no attention to this moment, since the world immediately starts making its impression on us. But you can also remain in a tranquil state as you awaken. And then you may notice that you were already perceiving something before you awoke. You can become especially aware of this if someone knocked at the door without knocking a second time. As you wake up, you can realize that something has happened, and that you know this from an overall sense of the situation. When we observe something like this, we are not too far removed from acknowledgement of what spiritual science must show, that we perceive our surroundings in far broader and more wide-ranging ways than we are consciously aware of. It simply is the case, say, when you walk down the road, and then see someone coming toward you round a corner that you sensed him beforehand. In countless instances you will have a sense of having seen him before you actually did. Before we ever perceive something, we are already in a soul spiritual connection with it. This is true, though usually our subsequent sensory perception conceals the fact. And we do not give proper attention to what occurs in the intimate subtleties of our soul life. Again, similarly, this is something that occurs unconsciously, like memory, or the feeling of gratitude I described toward all phenomena around us. The dead can speak to us only through the element infusing the dreams emerging in our life. They speak what they have to say to us into this intimate, unconsciously occurring mode of perception. And they can do so if we are able to share a soul spiritual atmosphere with them. If they are to speak to us, we have to introduce into our awareness, something of the sense of gratitude I described, one toward everything that reveals itself to us. If we bear no such sense of gratitude within us, are unable to thank the world for giving us life and enriching it continually with new impressions, are incapable of deepening our soul experience by bearing in mind that all of life is a gift, the dead will not find a common atmosphere with us. You see, they can only speak to us through such a feeling of gratitude, for otherwise there is a wall between them and us which obstructs communication. We will soon discover how many hindrances exist to this communication with the dead. As we have seen from other contexts, this communication is always with the dead we are karmically connected with. When we have lost them but keep wishing they were still there, we cannot cultivate the thought that we are grateful for their part in our lives, irrespective of the fact that they are no longer there. Then our sense of gratitude does not come into play toward the being whom we wish to approach, and then the soul does not find us, or at least is unable to speak to us. The very feelings we often have toward the dead we have been close to will prevent the dead from speaking to us. Other dead souls who have no karmic connection with us usually speak to us only with greater difficulty, but in relation to people close to us, we cultivate too little gratitude for the part they played in our lives. We fail to see that we ought not to cling to the thought of having lost them, for this has no gratitude in it, in the broader scheme of things. If we realized how greatly the sense of loss overshadows our sense of gratitude, then we could comprehend the full scope of what I am saying. We feel the loss of a close relative, but then we should really try to find in ourselves a sense of gratitude that this person was there in our life. We must try to reflect selflessly on what he meant to us until he died, rather than on our feelings of loss and grief that he is no longer there. The better we can feel what he meant to us while he was alive, the more easily he can find ways to speak to us, and through the shared atmosphere of gratitude, he will be able to approach us with what he has to say. But other things are necessary too, if we are to enter ever more consciously into the world where these things hold sway. Imagine that a child of yours dies. You can cultivate a feeling of togetherness with him, for instance, by picturing yourself sitting and playing with him, and being as interested in the game you are playing as the child is himself. If you can be as interested in a game as the child himself, you will have that shared feeling you have when you actually play with a child. Something worth doing only if the game means as much to you as it does to the child. This creates the kind of atmosphere that is necessary for the feeling of togetherness. So if you picture yourself playing with the child, and really engage in this in a lively way, you create a locus upon which your gaze and his can both fall. And if you are able to grasp what the dead soul is saying, then you cultivate a conscious connection with him, and this can in turn be sustained by various other things. You will think this is not so, but some people find thinking extremely easy. If people find it difficult, this engenders a different feeling. Those who give little thought to thinking are precisely the ones who find it most difficult, and this is because they are lazy thinkers. When I say that most people give no thought to thinking, I mean they take it very lightly, terribly lightly. They just think without any idea that it could be a difficult undertaking. They formulate their thoughts and have them and live in them. But then other things, such as spiritual science, approach them. Spiritual science is something so many people steer clear of, not because it is hard to understand, but because we need to make a certain effort to absorb it. People are wary of such effort. As we delve further into spiritual science, we gradually discover that grasping the thoughts it contains requires a real effort of will, and that an exertion of will is not just something you do when you lift weights, say, but also when you form thoughts. But people are generally disinclined to engage in such effort. They think easily and effortlessly. Precisely when we make headway in thinking, we discover that our thinking becomes harder and harder, increasingly ponderous, if I can put it like that, because we increasingly have the sense that real effort is needed for a thought to form in us. There's really nothing better for helping us delve further into the world of spirit than finding it harder and harder to formulate thoughts. The best progress in spiritual science is made, really, if we no longer regard thinking as something easy, an ordinary part of life, but instead as something we really have to sweat over, like threshing, an effort and exertion similar to that needed when threshing corn. The feeling I mean is something I can only hint at, but it really can emerge and is a very good and favorable development. This also relates to various other things. For instance, the gradual fading of something common to a great many people. Many people's thinking is so quick that they immediately grasp a whole context of ideas when someone just refers to it in passing. They know the context and can immediately reply. Discussion in literary salons would be hard-pressed if thinking grew more difficult. But we can discover that as we gradually become more acquainted with the inner nature of things, it becomes harder for us to fire off a quick retort, which is something accomplished only by easy and superficial thinking. As our knowledge advances, we become ever more Socratic. We become aware that much effort is needed, and that we only gain the right to voice our opinion about something by making strenuous exertions. This feeling that an exertion of will is needed to grasp thoughts is related to another feeling within us that we sometimes have when we work hard at committing things to memory and find that we cannot retain them. There is certainly a connection between these two things. The difficulty of retaining something we are trying to commit to memory and the difficulty of trying to grasp thoughts which require a great exertion of will. But this can be practiced. We can apply what I would call conscientiousness and a sense of responsibility toward thinking. For instance, if, based on a certain experience of life, someone comments that so-and-so is a good person, another may fire back agreement without thinking. Yes, a really good person. Consider how often answers consist only of a comparative intensifier. In fact, there is no reason whatever to use the comparative form here. We ought to have a real experience of what we utter, rather than simply going one better than what the other has said. But naturally, this should not be taken too far, since otherwise silence would fall in many salons. It may be hard to believe, but it is true. This awakening feeling of responsibility toward thinking, this sense that thinking is hard work, is a foundation for the capacity to receive illumined insights. You see, illumination does not come to us in the way thoughts emerge for most people, but always attended by a sense of difficulty. We must first learn to experience thoughts as difficult undertakings, and the memorization of something is different from merely thinking. And then we can have a feeling of how thoughts surface in a faint and dreamlike way in the soul, and are hard to pin down, are fleeting and fade as quickly as they come. We can help ourselves to grasp them if we develop a sense of the reality of thoughts we live with. For instance, be clear what happens inwardly in you if you decide to go somewhere and then arrive where you intended. Usually we give no thought to such things, but it is possible to reflect on what happens in the soul when we form an intention, realize it, and achieve what we decided on. Something has altered inwardly in us. We can get a vivid sense of this in a mountain climber who huffs and puffs up a steep slope and then, arriving at the summit, cries out, "We did it!" You can feel that something has changed inwardly in his feelings. But a similar kind of feeling can develop in us, though in a subtler, more intimate realm. If we begin to reflect on our relationship with someone who has died, if we try to share interests in common with him and connect with the other's thoughts and feelings, then we will feel ourselves to be embarking on a path. And then a moment will come when we feel we have, as it were, come to rest in these thoughts. If we can do this, first move into and in a thought, and then bring it into equilibrium, we can have the sense of first moving or walking, and then coming to a stop and standing. By doing this, we have done much to facilitate illumined insights that can form in us as thoughts. This illumination through thoughts can enable us to put our whole being into something, rather than the little we usually bring to bear on situations. And naturally, this leads us into greater and subtler intimations. If you invoke awareness of this otherwise unconscious feeling of gratitude I spoke about earlier, you will immediately notice that, unlike ordinary feelings of thankfulness, you seek to connect your whole being with it, through into your arms and hands at least. And here I must remind you of what I said about the aspect of human sensibility in which we grasp our ordinary thoughts, while subtler ones pass through the brain as if through a sieve. These latter are really received by our arms and hands. This can be a real experience. We do not actually have to move our arms to experience this, but can gain a sense that the arms wish to express this feeling of gratitude and other similar feelings too, such as wonder and reverence. This experience comes to expression in partial ways, a kind of impetus in arms and hands, as witness to subconscious impulses, when we feel suddenly moved to fold our hands together at the beauties of nature, or as we contemplate something that has occurred. Everything that occurs in our subconscious comes to subtle or partial expression in life. We don't necessarily move our arms, but we have a sense that they want to move in sympathy with outward impressions. Only the ether body moves, our etheric arms and hands. The more we become aware of this, and the more, indeed, that we become able to feel the nature of outward impressions with our arm organism, that blue, say, makes you want to move your hand in a certain way, and red in another way, and that this movement belongs to each impression, the more we can also develop a feeling for illuminations, for inner impressions that seek entry to the soul. If we give ourselves up to such things, as I described in relation to a child playing, we find ourself by losing ourselves in these impressions. And then illumination can enter us once we have become able to make our whole being receptive for an impression. Once we have also learned to plunge into our own thoughts of the dead person, and there create a sense of real togetherness with him, and then awakening from this experience again, and uniting it with the whole of our being, learn to let feelings of gratitude flow right through into our arms and hands, as I described. You see, the spiritual reality in which the dead person exists, between death and a new birth, is such that we as living people can find him by meeting him in a shared locus of spirit, in a thought that he too can perceive. As long as we can meet him there with a full sense of commonality and togetherness, in the medium of gratitude, we have the means to do so. The dead speak to the living out of a space that is woven from a feeling of togetherness, through an atmosphere formed from a sense of universal gratitude toward the world. The end of Lecture 6.